It being 1 o'clock, we'll call the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division to order. First, we do not have a quorum, but we'll get started on hearing House File 3430, Representative Grunhagen. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seeing as how we were snowed in all weekend, had nothing else to do, my wife made some cookies. I'd like to pass those around for the members and anybody else who'd like to have a homemade cookie, Mr. Chair.
Ah, thank you, Rep. Anderson. The DFL caucus should be here.
I can cover for him with the cookies.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lunan moves. Okay. So, Grunhagen, go ahead and state your bill.
Well, yeah, we don't have a quorum yet, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, what House File 3430 does, it provides a reduced class rate for craft or retreat houses. I think most rural members, probably Metro also, have some of these in their district. I do have some handouts. Oh, they're going around. And in the handouts, there's a graph that shows a certain percentage of these retreat houses and craft houses are put in a commercial property tax bracket. The result is it puts a huge burden on these craft and retreat houses, and many of them are on the verge or have gone out of business. So what this does, this bill would move these commercial, craft, and retreat homes into the bed and breakfast same category in property tax. So they still would pay property tax, but it would be reduced by approximately 45 to 50%. I do have a couple testifiers that would like to speak on the bill, and I also have their tax representative along if you have any specific or technical questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. With that, members, we do have a quorum present now. Representative Lunan moves House File 3430 laid over for possible inclusion. With that, Representative Grunhagen, to your witnesses.
Yeah.
Okay,
thank
my
you.
First testifier is John Ritting. John, please introduce yourself and give your testimony.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Thank you, everyone. My name is John Ritting, and my wife who's over there, Lisa Ritting. We own a house in Center City that we rent out as a crafting retreat house. It's a mom-pa side business for us. Our crafting retreat house we call Timber Haze Retreat. It's a three-bedroom residential home that is rented primarily to quilting and scrapbooking groups of approximately eight people. Most of our rentals are for 2 to 4 nights. And there's a little more information about our house with a picture of it in the handout material that you'll be receiving. Unfortunately, crafting retreat houses do not neatly fit the description of any of the 34 Minnesota property tax classifications, particularly none of the Class 4 property tax classifications. In 2016, Chisago County assessors changed the classification of our crafting retreat house from residential non-homestead to commercial. As a result, our property taxes increased by 116% that year, from $3,384 to $8,306, and there's a copy of that property tax notification that you're also receiving in the handout material. We appealed the change of the classification in Chisago County, but learned through that process that since our property does not meet the definition of any of the non-commercial Class 4 property tax classifications, by default our property was classified as 3A, or commercial industrial, the same as a hotel or motel. Through the appeal process, we were advised that the only remedy to get out of the 3A classification is to seek a modification to the property tax statute so that a provision could be made for residential properties like ours that are used as crafting retreats similar to a bed and breakfast. I wondered if all crafting retreat houses in Minnesota were classified as commercial, like ours, and so I decided to do an investigation. So I went through and found approximately 60 crafting retreat houses in Minnesota. I did this in December 2016, so it is analysis that could be updated. But I analyzed the property tax classifications of those approximately 60 retreat houses with 3 to 5 sleeping units and to determine how others were being classified across the state. And what I found is in the pie chart that you have in your handout, and you can see according to the pie chart, 37% of crafting retreat houses are classified as commercial, 30% non-homestead, 26% as homestead, 9% seasonal, recreational, and only 4% bed and breakfast. So you can see there's a great deal of inconsistency, and I think a lot of that just has to do with the fact that there really isn't a statute that where crafting retreat houses really fit. So we believe the 3 to 5 unit crafting retreat houses in Minnesota like ours are most similar to a bed and breakfast for several reasons. One, it's a residential house with 3 to 5 sleeping units. The retreats are typically mom-pa operations like ours. They have very little impact on local infrastructure, unlike commercial hotels, motels, or even resorts. And the reason we are opting for the bed and breakfast rather than seasonal recreational is there would just have to be major changes to the seasonal recreational statute to accommodate our type of operation. So we believe that expanding the scope and definition of the bed and breakfast 4C9 is the best solution to providing an opportunity for crafting retreat houses to be classified similar to a bed and breakfast. And that's what the proposed modification to 273.13 subdivision 25 4C9 in this bill would do. It would expand the definition of bed and breakfast, thus enabling Minnesota County assessors to consistently classify crafting retreat houses at the bed and breakfast rate. At the same, I also want to add one more thing. It does, crafting retreat houses like ours are really good for rural tourism in Minnesota. Many of them are located outstate Minnesota. But the business really is barely viable with the commercial property tax rate, because it really impacts negatively our return on investment. Furthermore, because of the inconsistent classification of crafting retreat houses, we can't really raise our rates to try to cover the higher fee, because we have many other retreat houses across Minnesota that have a different cost structure than we do. And if we really are unable to see a path to getting to a non-commercial classification for our property, we may have to seriously consider closing our side business as well. So your support of this bill is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, I've neglected to. I do have one technical amendment that I'd like to offer at this time.
Okay.
It's on line 6.3. It'd be page 6 of the bill. And it'd be right at the top, 6.13. And in front of the word areas, I would insert also the words meals or. So it would read meals or areas to prepare meals are provided. This technical amendment simply makes sure that bed and breakfasts aren't excluded from the bill. And that was recommended by House Research. Is everybody?
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Lunan moves the oral amendment to line 6.3, inserting the words meal or in front of the word areas. Any discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, it's meals, correct? Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
It's inserting meals or, not just meal, meals, right?
Meal.
Thank you.
Clarification, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that you don't want to get rid of the current bed and breakfast, but this seems to me that it would broadly expand a variety of rental entities that don't provide meals. The bed and breakfast, you have to provide breakfast at least. And this seems to me like you could end up with a lot of potentially Airbnbs and others who potentially could try and find a way to qualify under this, because they just have to have a kitchen, which is what's, I think, is located in almost every residential property that's ever been built. And so I'm just concerned that we are, to solve one problem, which sounds like there's some confusion because they're classified in different ways, to solve one problem, we're going to create more. And I think we need to understand more what this means to take away the obligation to provide meals. And because there's a lot of facilities that don't provide meals, that would be glad to say, are you going to do some knitting while you're visiting? Well, then I think we qualify.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And I'm assuming you're speaking to the amendment and not the bill. And
right, to the amendment. I just feel like, and perhaps our staff or the Department of Revenue could address whether this really broadens the option that's available to other properties.
Okay. Any other questions, comments regarding the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. As
Mr. Chair, I have one more testifier.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Please proceed and identify yourself for the record.
Hi. My name is Kelly Reiner. I live about 60 miles west, Hutchinson, in McLeod County. And I opened, I have three houses now that we use for a crafting retreat. And I'm just going to tell you my little backstory of how I started. So Pheasant Run Retreat is a five-bedroom house located on 150 acres. We built this house in 2001 and lived in it until 2007 when we moved to my husband's home farm. I am a scrapbooker and had been to other retreats and knew that our house would make a great place for guests to come and use our space for their hobbies. We started the process to get licensed through the county and even went to our county assessors to find out how the property would be classified. We were told that it would be classified as a non-homestead property. We continued through the licensing process to get the conditional use permit, and then we started remodeling the garage to serve as our craft room to provide a house for scrapbookers and quilters with overnight lodging and use of the kitchen. In 2008, we opened Pheasant Run after being inspected by the Minnesota Department of Health and submitting paperwork to the state of Minnesota. Pheasant Run is now rented to groups of up to 15 guests for a minimum of a two-night stay. In the fall of 2009, we bought a parcel of farmland that had a house on the property and decided to start a second one as I was turning people away. Most weekends, my weekends were full. So in the spring of 2011, we opened Plum Creek Retreat, following the same guidelines that I just listed. And just prior to opening that second retreat, we received a letter in the mail that stated that our property for the first one would now be changing to a commercial classification. After visiting the assessor, making many visits and calls to get this changed, we have gotten nowhere. In 2013, we appealed to the county board. They were very sympathetic to our situation and also didn't agree with the classification, but relied on the assessor to know more about it than they did. They suggested I contact the state property tax division. I did contact the state and talked to Steve Herney of the property tax division, and he also was sympathetic to our situation and that we just don't fit anywhere else but commercial. That's where they've been putting us. So I was advised that the statute would have to be amended in order to include my type of business.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions of Ms. Reiner? Seeing none, thank you. Representative Grunhagen, did you have Ms. Regenauer here?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
She doesn't have any prepared comments, but if you have any tax questions, she could respond for that.
I did not. I just saw that she was on the list of testifiers.
Oh, okay. Lynn, do you want to say anything?
What I would like to say is about the taxes.
Please.
I'm sorry, I'm Lynn Regenauer. Sorry. The tax implication differences. I did.
Did
you hear me introduce myself?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, my name is Lynn Regenauer.
There you go.
Please speak into the mic for everybody. Thank you.
The tax implementation. Can't even talk now. What happens when these properties are taxed commercially compared to other ones is staggering, to say the least. I did a tax calculation on Ridning's house that they have in as commercial. I also did a tax calculation as if it was a bed and breakfast, as if it was a residential homestead or a non-homestead, which would be a rental property that somebody is leasing out 12 months out of the year and collecting income from. If it was a non-homestead residentially, the tax would have been $3,996. As a homestead, $3,866. As a bed and breakfast, $3,977. The way it's taxed right now is $8,172. And what we're finding is this is very inequitable, considering it's a house, just like a bed and breakfast is, just like a rental house is. And it's just hard to take is to have a tax burden like that on something that would sell on the open market as a house. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions of Mrs. Regenauer? Seeing none, is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing please state your name for the record, please, and who you represent.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Tom May, the representative of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, contacted me this morning with concerns about this bill that did frankly comport with mine as well. He could not be here because he's stuck up north due to the snowstorm, but what I'm going to convey is our common concerns. While we appreciate the concerns that are trying to be addressed by this bill, we think the language needs substantial work before that. Currently, to qualify for the bed and breakfast qualifications, the owner must reside in the premise. The second issue has been addressed by the technical amendment that meals are provided to persons who rent rooms and that the owner is the operator of the property. And then the language goes on to provide that it's essentially limited to up to 5 units within the facility. And then any units beyond that are classified as commercial. Our first concern, obviously, is that it's eliminated the requirement that the owner reside on the premise. Quite frankly, this opens it up substantially larger than I think what is envisioned here. Our belief is that this, frankly, could apply to any motel that has breakfast facilities where individuals could prepare their meals for up to the 5 units. Secondly, lack of the requirement of residing on the premise does obviously open it up substantially. And finally, it's somewhat confusing here because the language on lines 5.32 that could be classified as Class 4B with minimal modifications introduces a degree of ambiguity that has to be addressed in one manner or another. 4B right now is generally duplexes and triplexes. Yet under this classification, as I noted for you, it could apply to up to 5 units. So something has to be resolved here. We do not know what minimal modifications are, that either the rooms could be consolidated to be 3 or less, the sleeping, or not sure what exactly that means. So I wanted to share those concerns. Again, we think the language as it is right now is a much broader application than just these craft houses. With that, I'll be happy to answer any concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Members, any questions of Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. And thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for trying to find a fix to this. It does seem confusing, and I apologize if this was answered already or said in the text. I have a lot of handouts here. I'm trying to find out if it was already said. But I'm just looking at our current classifications, and I know we're talking about moving this potentially into the bed and breakfast. Is there a reason why, and Mr. May, in your opinion, would it make sense to put it into the 4A, residential non-homestead 4-plus unit classification?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whalen, you know, from our perspective, the counties and the assessors, we just have to know the appropriate place to put it. 4A, as you noted, would be essentially apartments of four units or more. That classification, I believe, has a class rate of 1.25%, which would be a reduction from the commercial, which is only 1.5% on the first 150,000 and 2% beyond. So if the objective is to provide some relief, if you can accurately define these entities, I concur with you, it might simplify things and better address the issue here.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your response, Mr. Carlson. This question might go to Representative Grunhagen then, but did you look at that possibility or other? I know it was said that it seemed that a bed and breakfast made the most sense to place this in. I actually, interestingly enough, just met with a couple of bed and breakfast owners today, and I think my biggest concern is removing the requirement that the owner live there, because that's obviously kind of one of the big designations of bed and breakfast, so it looks like we would expand this quite a bit. But just wondering your thoughts on 4A.
Mr. Carlson.
Or no, I think she wanted to pick up.
I think. Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Whalen. Yeah, we hadn't received any pushback on this bill whatsoever since it was introduced, and it's been introduced a long time other than this morning, and as Mr. Carlson said, he didn't have a chance to talk to me at all. Mm-hmm. So this is the first I've heard of those concerns, mm-hmm. All right? And I'm willing to discuss that and try to address it with staff to narrow it or change the classification if it still gives the type of relief that we're looking for. But without previous notice, it's hard to respond to that. But yeah, I'd be open to being flexible about it.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. That's good to know, and be happy to chat more offline.
Okay. Any other questions? Anyone else from the audience that would like to testify?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, would staff, based on the testimony they've heard, is it possible to address his concerns, Mr. Carlson's concerns, in the bill? Just
Mr.
an
Knight?
Initial thought. I know we're putting you on the spot.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, I think some of the concerns could be addressed, particularly that language on line 5.31. But I think some of the broader questions that have been raised about whether it includes Airbnb and whether it includes small hotels, or there might be some trickier issues there, but I'm certainly willing to try to work on some more language. In fact, I have drafted some other language that we could look at and see how that might address those. But I think it is a classification that's kind of tricky to put a definite boundary around when you start thinking about possibilities. And I think with regard to the 4A, I would, you know, that's apartments, and which is typically what we think of as, you know, at least rental periods of 30 days or longer. So I'm not sure that this would fit into that classification, but I think a B&B expansion or some clause similar to B&B treatment would be a more likely place, but we can work on that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that response, Mr. Hinz. Does any one of my testifiers want to respond to the concerns that have been mentioned briefly?
Lynn Regenauer.
Please state your name again for the record, please.
Lynn Regenauer. What I want to mention about this commercial classification also that is not part of any of these other classifications is the commercial classification has a state general rate, tax rate. So part of this $8,172 that they are paying in property tax, $1,579 goes to pay to the state general tax. None of these other houses have got that kind of a tax added to them. It's only the commercial classification. And when we were looking at which laws to change or to amend or whatever, the minimal modification came up because it was almost assumed that these houses had storefronts to them, and that's why they were being put in as a commercial classification or should be. These houses don't. They've got usually a room set aside for doing crafting or whatever. But, you know, if you go on MLS or you go and look at new construction blueprints, people commonly now have rooms set aside for exercising, for crafting and hobbies, for shops, for I've even got one with a brew room in it now. So it's not uncommon for houses to have separate rooms set aside for doing these type of activities. And that's why the minimum modification language got in there, is just because it was thought that there was some major project that was going to need to be done to modify these houses back so that they could be sold on open market. And that wasn't the case. I forgot, what was the other thing that was addressed?
Residing in the, yeah, in the house.
Representative, we have a question from Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hate to interrupt, but when we're talking about taking different approaches, maybe Mr. Hines could answer me on this one. When you look at the sections on 3.17 through 3.24 that talks about recreational activity definitions, would it be easier just to add to that recreational activity definition what we're trying to attempt to do here instead of talking about the meals? Or I mean, I noticed there's convention center in there, you know. I don't know, it's just another option. I didn't mean to stop the train of thought there.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, it's possible that this kind of an activity or a use of the property could be fit into that commercial, seasonal, recreational classification. I believe that testifiers thought that it was the least amount of change needed to the statutes to put them in with the B&Bs, but I would have to sort of study the specifics of where there might be some problems with fitting them into that category, but it's possible that that could be another place that they could go.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunhagen, we've got the agenda. Any concluding remarks, please?
Just, you know, these houses provide a service, increase tourism in our districts. Most of us, I think, have these in our districts, and to put them in a commercial property tax is a, you know, some of them are closing down, some of them on the verge of closing down, and I just encourage the committee to consider putting them in a more reasonable and more property tax area, and one that fits more with the types of services that they provide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, Representative Lunan renews his motion to lay over House File 3430 as amended. All in favor? You don't have to vote on it.
Thank you.
I'll move the minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the minutes from the last meeting.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. 11. Representative Lunan moves the minutes of April 12th. Any amendments or suggestions? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 The minutes are adopted. Moving on, we'll go back to the top of the agenda, House File 3688, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Erickson moves House File 3688 be laid over to the general register. Yeah, be moved to the general register. With that, welcome, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before I get started, there should have been a handout in your folder that would look like this. I could just have you have that available as part of my presentation here today. Mr. Chair and members, the bill that's before us in your committee today, House File 3688, is as a result of over a year's worth of work. It began last session with a mandate to do a work group on this, and the work group has met over the interim and has come back with a product. And this bill is oftentimes referred to as the PACE bill, P-A-C-E, Property Assessed Clean Energy. And I am not here today to debate the merits of clean energy and to talk about that portion of the mechanism. I'm here to talk about the first part, the property assessed. Under Minnesota law, we have a couple of different priority liens. One of those is taxes, and the second is special assessments on real estate, regardless of what other liens have been recorded on the property. Earlier this session, at the end of last session, when we were looking at PACE, the Property Assessed Clean Energy Bill, and the process here in the state of Minnesota, I became very, very concerned that many people who may take advantage of this may not be walking into what they think they're walking into, given the fact that under Minnesota law, special assessment liens would take priority over all other liens except property taxes. So one of the things that I'm concerned about is as folks who may have limited income, an inability to be able to go and borrow money from a lender to make some improvements to their energy code improvements to their home, that they would take advantage of a city or local unit of government having gone out and sold bonds for a pool of money and backed by special assessments. When we began the session, we had a group that wanted us to follow a business model that they have developed and were successful in getting incorporated into state law in the state of California. And what that would, in essence, do would allow, under the law here in the state of Minnesota, if you take a look at your graph, on the left-hand side, it says the first lien is always going to be your property tax liens due on May 15th and October 15th. On the property example that you see in front of you, there's a primary mortgage. So someone purchased this home, went out and secured financing on it, and recorded in the county recorder's office on the 24th of April, 2011, in this example, was the first mortgage. Then there was a subsequent lien that was filed on the property. It could be a home equity loan. It could be a mechanics lien or any other type of lien. And the way that law works in Minnesota is that in the dates that these are recorded into the public record is their priority lien on here. What I want you to do is I want you to drop down to that fourth box and grab your pencil, and I want you to draw, or your pen, where it says residential PACE loan, although it says March 15th, 2018 on there. You can draw an arrow and insert that between the first tax lien and the second primary mortgage lien, because that's where that lien would go under current law in the state of Minnesota. I'm very concerned because folks who would use this would be folks who might be in an established neighborhood, perhaps limited income, first-time home buyers. And what could end up happening to those individuals is they could have a first mortgage on their property, some other special assessment liens for road improvements and different types of things, and a PACE a lien on the property. In essence, render that property unable to be sold because there's more indebtedness against that property than the market will bear for the sale of that property. When we were first working with this, we heard some of the opponents to my bill stating that, well, nowhere in the state of Minnesota, well, I should say the country, has there ever been a default on one of these PACE assessments on here. Well, that would make sense. If I was the lender who was in the first mortgage position, I would no doubt pay the property taxes and the special assessment lien on the property to preserve my position on that property. So in essence, what's happening is people who are Johnny-come-latelys, if you will, are getting a higher priority lien than the first mortgage or other mortgage lien holders given the function of law. The second column, this bill advocates is that if you are a PACE loan, same type of liens on the property. However, on the revised that we're looking at in this bill, it would be treated no different than any other type of loan on the property and would take priority in the time that it was recorded. It would not have that special or preferential tax lien position. And, Mr. Chair, that is the things that affect the bill that would be within the jurisdiction or the scope of the Property Tax Committee this afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Members, do you have questions of this bill? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is sort of a, you know, we've seen it in other years, but it's kind of unique in that the payments for the loan are actually done through the property tax bill. And, you know, that's not a typical home improvement type of effort. It turns the county into the calculators, the assessors, especially if you ended up with variable interest loans and all those sorts of things. And, you know, I'm wondering if you could, if Representative Driscoll could explain a little bit more about how does that obligation work with the counties, and are variable interest loans with changing amounts, prepayment opportunities, all that sort of thing going to create some real administrative complications here?
Thank you for that question, Representative Loeffler. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, that's a great question. We don't have any of these in Minnesota, so we don't know for sure how this would end up working. We have them on the commercial side. We do not have them on the residential side. My assumption involved in city government would be that if the city chose to do something like this, they would levy, they would sell bonds, and those would be a fixed rate for a period of maybe 10 years or 15 years, whatever time that they were looking at doing it. And we continue to follow any of the other prepayment processes for special assessments in the state of Minnesota. It's just what's being backed by that special assessment. In this case, property assessed clean energy improvements versus roads or sidewalks or sewer or water or other types of special assessments that may be levied against the property.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we should hear from our local governments about their interest in pursuing this and how those administrative costs get handled. It does imply, I think, potentially to the person who might take out one of these loans that this is somehow government authorized, and yet, you know, your bill requires a lot of disclosure, including the fact that, you know, it may make it harder to sell your house. And you reference California. I have a former constituent who I've stayed in touch with who's moved to California, and she's now retired. And she says she is constantly being called. This requires recording of the telephone solicitation. I'm not sure if telemarketing is the approach to improving your energy is the one that we want to authorize with as opposed to in-person meetings or whatever. I'm just feeling like maybe this is something I'd be more comfortable with as a pilot project than a statewide authorization to see what are the complications in terms of its marketing, in terms of the obligations and responsibilities that we're putting on local governments to keep track of these things, particularly when it can be a 20-year loan and many people will be taking it out and being obligated to pay for it after they've hit the point of retirement. So it's not just do you qualify at the time you're taking it out, but can you actually sustain this through what for most people is a really big change in their financial picture?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, this is a situation that what you're describing is what this bill is looking to do, is to protect consumers from people coming and saying, oh, you don't even have to go to the bank to borrow money. You don't even have to qualify. We'll just add it to your property taxes. There is no qualifying. And then it becomes a priority lien on the property, subject to Minnesota's property foreclosure. After 5 years, if you don't pay, you lose your property back to tax forfeiture. This bill also put in some safeguards and some rails for people so that they knew what they were getting into, increasing the amount of disclosure, increasing the amount of consumer awareness before they would even enter into something like this. The way it sits right now, the group that was advocating their business model in the state of Minnesota, I learned this morning, has pretty much given up their efforts to try to advance that cause and have that be a part of state law. And we've been very successful with the authors and the committee staffs that we've had with people having comfort in this approach. As a matter of fact, Representatives Joaquim, Lunan, Barr, and Nelson have all heard this in other committees that I've had in committee staff. We've been through, I think this is our fifth or sixth committee staff that we've been on, and we've got strong bipartisan support. I'm very concerned that folks are going to be taken advantage of if we don't have something like this. It's not handled differently than any other assessment under current law. All we're saying is if the city does this, and under the statute change that we're proposing, it becomes a lien on the property as a loan lien, not as a special assessment lien, which would take priority, which would really disadvantage those individuals in the purchase and sale of that property. It absolutely is going to affect the marketability of that product.
Representative Laughlin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Driscoll. My understanding is that none of these are being offered right now in the residential market, although they are in other states. And as I said, I am aware that there have been issues in some other states. So I think the idea of going slow. But we know the financial literacy of our average homeowner is not as great as one would hope. Our average citizen has challenges, let's just say. And I think that we ought to go slow before we create a statewide program. And you know, that's why I raised the issue of potentially a pilot that could come back and we could see what kind of feedback we get from the people served as well as the local governments involved.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Barr has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Driscoll, it's just to follow up, but I think you've already answered. You are not advocating for PACE loans at all. You're just trying to protect consumers should PACE loans become offered in the state of Minnesota, correct?
Correct.
Representative Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, we're trying to set the ground rules so that there's transparency up front and so that, in essence, you don't have people who come into the community and say, have we got a deal for you? And then they leave, and the homeowner in a couple of years figures out, hey, wait a second, this might not have been the best deal. My hunch is that I'm being joined to my right by Mr. Elwood from Legal Services. But now that I've mentioned Mr. Elwood, this is a large coalition of providers, Mr. Elger, Ager from the Minnesota Association of Realtors. We also have the mortgage banking industry. We have the credit unions that are on board with us. We also have legal aid. So this is a, as this has been going through the process, been called the unholy alliance because you don't see these groups of people always coming together and advocating for something like this, and they are all on board. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'll hear what Mr. Ager has.
So this is going to be like the Price is Right show. Come on down if you have something to say. Welcome. State your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Eggern with the Minnesota Realtors Association, and here in support of Representative O'Driscoll's bill. And just listening to Representative Loeffler's questions, I wanted to attempt to maybe add some to clarify what this bill does in relation to current law. And Representative Barr was getting at this issue, but residential PACE or PACE was authorized in Minnesota with some enabling language, I believe, in 2009 or 2010. So the statutory authorization to introduce residential PACE programs had already existed in law. Last session, Representative O'Driscoll carried a bill that suspended that authorization and also created a Consumer Protection Legislation Task Force. That task force, of all kind of the interested stakeholders, was convened by the Department of Commerce, led by the Department of Commerce, met over the summer and into the fall, produced a report and some recommendations, including kind of two different versions of legislation. Representative O'Driscoll is carrying the version that's supported by the realtors, the bankers, the credit unions, legal aid, and Center for Energy and Environment, along with other groups that have indicated their support. The purpose of this legislation is to provide better, more comprehensive regulations than exist under current law. This isn't meant to introduce residential PACE from scratch. That already exists in law. This is meant to create the conditions under which it would move. You could allow a program in Minnesota. So I hope that provides maybe some more information about the genesis of this. That if this bill doesn't create residential PACE. Residential PACE already was authorized in current law.
Thank you, Mr. Ager. And, you know, in real estate, the order of recording has generally been the status of priority. And in the difference of special assessments, as Representative O'Driscoll has pointed out, the one is initiated by the public as a improvement to the property. And in this case, it's initiated by the consumer themselves. So that really shouldn't move ahead, as Representative O'Driscoll has pointed out, and it should be junior to any first mortgage. I would certainly concur with that. Anyone else would like to ask Mr. Ager a question? If not, is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, if you'd like to make concluding remarks, Representative O'Driscoll, feel free
to do
so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have worked hard on this, and as Mr. Eger said, this is not introducing it. It's helping set the ground rules for this as an option in the state of Minnesota. And we think it's a fair way to be able to cover all interested parties. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the committee's support.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Erickson renews her motion to move this House File 3688 to the General Register. I'm sorry. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Speak up.
Chair and members, thank you.
With that, next on the agenda, we'll call down Representative Bliss, House File 4063. With that, Representative Barr moves House File 4063 for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My House File 4063 tries to address a problem that we have in rural Minnesota, that natural gas is cost prohibitive to get to some of my communities, and this bill will try to address that. I have some testifiers with me today, and the first one that will be testifying is one of the cities in my district, the city of Walker, and this is the mayor, Jed Shaw.
Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I am Jed Shaw, and I'm the mayor of the city of Walker.
I think you've been here a couple times already this year,
haven't I? I have been here. Yes, I have. I'm getting a little bit used to the
Welcome
news.
Back.
Yeah, thank you very much. We have struggled to bring natural gas to our small town for over 20 years. Because of the costs of such an endeavor, we have never been able to accomplish this goal. It was simply too expensive. I am here to urge you to pass the levy exemption bill. No one single act will have as broad or positive economic impact as this will. This benefits Cass County, as we are the county seat, the city of Walker, its residents and businesses both, as well as the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. My understanding is that this is the final component that would allow the installation of the infrastructure necessary to bring natural gas to our town. In closing, please, I urge you, pass the levy exemption bill and help us to finally accomplish this goal. Thank you for time and consideration.
Would this gas line come down Hubbard County 24 on its way to Walker?
Hubbard County 24 on its way to Walker? I don't think so.
Just hoping, yeah. Just hoping. let's go ahead and...
Mr. Chair, I have more testifiers.
Yes, we'll hear from them all first.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Gregory Palmer. I'm the president of Greater Minnesota Gas Company. It's a natural gas distribution company in rural Minnesota, and its sister company, Greater Minnesota Transmission. If you have not received packets, I can have the clerk hand these out. There should be in the briefing papers, but if there's not, I'd like you to have them. If you can see from the map in the packet, we serve a number of rural counties. Basically, my company is focused on providing natural gas service in the state where it's not previously been provided. I think if you have natural gas at your home or your business, you're probably thinking, this is a basic entitlement and I take it for granted. But there's thousands of Minnesotans around the state that have not received this service. In some cases, they've been working for 20 or 30 or 40 years trying to get it, and it's not been economic. Access to natural gas is a function of two things. One is the population density where you happen to live, and the second is the distance from the traditional interstate pipelines. Those are natural gas pipelines that go between states. Many of the communities we work with are 20 or 30 miles away from those interstate pipelines, and so you need a significant investment in infrastructure to get gas service to them. If you look at the cost of extending that service, it's much higher than if you happen to be close to the interstate pipeline or you're in a much more densely populated area. We're not asking the state to subsidize the investment, but I'd ask you to look at the chilling effect that property taxes have on the extension of natural gas to rural Minnesota. For my company, over 10% of what we charge customers is a collection of property tax for the state. And so that is a threshold number that causes some of these projects to be built and a lot of them not to go forward. If you look at the property tax for gas utilities, some people may not be aware. Gas utilities pay property tax on the real estate they own. They also pay property tax on the personal property that they have in the ground. So to the extent we have pipe investment in the ground, we pay a personal property tax on that. And because there's a lot greater distance between each of our customers, it's much higher than people in more densely populated areas or closer to the interstate. The heavy burden of property tax is really limiting where we can extend gas service. What we've asked here is a 12-year moratorium. That allows us to make the investment and improves the economic models that we use to decide whether to make our investment or not. At the end of the 12 years, the distribution systems would go into the state's tax base, and that would be a benefit. One of you might ask, why don't we already have these investments? And the reason is the low-hanging fruit has already been served. People that are close to these pipelines in densely populated areas have been able to serve. We're talking about the next tranche of Minnesotans that don't have this service. So without the relief, it won't be built. If you give the relief, we can build some of these pipelines, serve more communities, and it not only creates a creation of the state's tax base, increases the state's property tax base, it also creates economic development. When I look at the communities we've extended natural gas to, some of them are shown on the map in your packet. You'll see investment in housing, in small businesses like metal fabrication and plastics extrusion, in new poultry operations, new grain operations, and other businesses in these small towns. It helps the business prosper. It helps the whole community prosper. I would also like to point out that there's an extensive need for the extension of natural gas for agricultural community. If you think about what you did this last weekend, many of us probably shoveled a driveway or something. Think if you had a large poultry operation with very large barns and you're worried about getting fuel supply out to those so you don't lose your animals. It can be an extensive impact. An underground network is much better prepared to deal with adversity caused by weather conditions, unexpected levels of crop drying, or other things you can't anticipate. It's a much more flexible system. I have two other parties here. The mayor of Walker has already spoken. I have two other parties that can share their insights into what it takes to get natural gas to rural Minnesota. But I ask you that you support this bill. It improves the standard of living and the quality of life for a lot of Minnesotans, and it ultimately increases the overall revenue base for the state of Minnesota in the long term if we can get this done.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Next, sir.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Thompson. I'm the CEO of Lake Region Electric Cooperative in Pelican Rapids. I'm also the CEO of Lake Region Energy Services. As most of you know, 80 years ago, electric cooperatives brought electricity to the rural areas, the countryside, to bring electricity for the first time to folks who live in those very rural areas. They came together at the grassroots level, formed a cooperative, and today our cooperative serves about 28,000 consumers within our service territory. However, today natural gas still does not exist in many of the small towns and communities and most of the rural area in which we serve. So last year, our board of directors of Lake Region Electric Cooperative approved a new venture, Lake Region Energy Services, designed to bring natural gas for the first time to some of the small towns and communities in our area. And I can tell you that it's been very exciting to work with these communities for the first time to bring natural gas to their towns. I just want to share with you what that experience has been like and some of the feedback that we have been getting. We've worked with school districts, for example, showed them how much they can save by converting to natural gas. How great is it in these small communities to work with a school system to help them save some of their energy dollars that can be redirected into their other budgets for their educational system? The large grain dryers and turkey farmers are saving a lot of money by switching to natural gas, working with folks on Main Street in these small towns, as well as the residential customers. Maybe we can save an average residential customer $300 to $400 per heating season, as an example. That's a lot of money to a lot of these people, and we're very excited to be able to be part of that. The first project was bringing gas to Deer Creek and Parker's Prairie. Deer Creek is about 350 people. Parker's Prairie is about 1,000 people. That was our first project, and I'm pleased to say it was a success this first year. Our board of directors recently approved our second projects that we will build this year. We are going to be bringing natural gas for the first time to the community of Dent, which is a population of 193, and to the community of Miltona, which is roughly 400. Last week, on Monday night, we had our first grassroots meeting in Tuesday night in those two communities. We first went to Miltona. Again, about 400 people live in that town. We got 80 people showed up, and the enthusiasm and the interest, and we get that question. Are you coming down my road? Are you coming to my area as well? We get that a lot. But the interest, the enthusiasm, the support that we're getting, the little town of Dent, about 193 people, 60 people showed up. Again, a lot of enthusiasm. And what happens in these meetings is not only do the people in those communities want it, but they know it's coming to their area and others want it. And so to get some tax relief, if you will, on the property taxes, to improve the economics, help us build out further and further into the rural areas is very important to us, and we just urge your support for us in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Anyone else? Please state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thanks for letting me be here today. My name is Mike Gorham. I'm the president of the Northwest Gas Group of Companies. My remarks are directed at my experience with a long-standing natural gas pipeline personal property tax issue. We talked about pipelines being personal property before. The inclusion of this bill in the omnibus tax package will go a long way towards fixing, in my view. My company builds and operates natural gas distribution systems to serve communities which are either small or are located a long ways away from existing transmission lines, or both. This service model that our company has results in a high capital cost either on a per customer or a per therm delivered basis, you know, per BTU basis coming through the pipe for our systems. On a capital cost per customer or per therm delivered basis, our systems cost at least twice that of other utilities which serve larger cities, which tend to have a higher concentration of big gas loads, or those located closer to gas transmission lines where we get our gas from. These are the systems that our company has built since 1992. They presently serve 14 small Minnesota communities that did not have natural gas before we showed up. Since we have these high capital costs per customer systems, and since our personal property taxes, as Greg said, are in significant part driven by the asset base that we employ to get gas there, our personal property tax is paid by our customers. They're a cost of business, so they get passed through to the customer, are also at least double those of utilities serving more traditional areas like big cities, big towns. In preparation for today, I looked up some of our numbers, which top out at $158 per customer per year just for property taxes and average about $75 a customer a year. And these are somewhere between 5 and 10 times what a CenterPoint customer or an Xcel customer would pay for something that has a lot lower capital cost per customer in their system. Natural gas utilities are kind of unique. In this area, other commercial properties for which property taxes are passed through, like apartment buildings, don't cost any more to build in Walker or in anywhere than they do in Minneapolis. Pipelines do cost a lot more because we have to go 20 miles to get there, and all those costs have to go into the system. And to me, this has always seemed to be undesirable piling on of taxes on top of an already high capital cost for these customers. We've repeatedly negotiated our property tax with the Department of Revenue, just southeast of here, and we found the department staff to be open to argument, they listen, but their hands are pretty much tied because there's very limited exclusions applicable to these systems, thus the high per customer taxes. Well, we're now at the point, like this year, where the property taxes, which would be applicable to new systems, not yet built systems, which have still higher capital costs than the ones we've already built, when combined with those systems' higher capital costs, pushes the total to the customer cost of the systems beyond economic feasibility. We're not going to, if we can't save the customers any money, we're not going to build the system because they're not going to sign up, kind of a thing. For example, cities like Walker, Ely, Grand Marais, there's a lot of other smaller ones that other people are looking at. So it comes, my thought is that it's both sad and less than optimal tax policy that high property taxes would keep citizens of more rural Minnesota communities or more dispersed or farther away from pipeline type communities from getting natural gas service when it would otherwise be feasible. I mean, we're not talking about subsidizing it. We're talking about not have the tax be the kicker. And inclusion of this bill would remove that threat of front-year taxes to these projects. And I ask that you adopt it as part of this omnibus package.
Thank you, Mr. Gorham. I was just about to ask you to wrap it up. Thank you.
Sorry.
Questions from members? Representative Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if this is for our bill's author, Representative Bliss, but is the 12 years simply so that, is that the break-even point so that, people start to experience the cost savings so it sort of offsets? Just trying to.
I got Mike Gorham, Northwest Gas. For us.
Go ahead, Mr. Gorham.
We have a ramp-up of customers. We don't get all the customers first year. And it takes, in our experience, 3 or 4 years to get real good saturation. And then the next 6 or 8 years would be spent recovering a lot of that capital cost. And that makes the ultimate. Those customers are still going to end up paying more in property taxes than their metro counterparts, but it's delayed, and that helps us with our cash flow for debt service.
Thank you. Did you want to respond to that question as well?
Mr. Chair, no, that was the correct answer.
Okay, thank you. Other members? Yeah, Representative Marquardt.
So, well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bliss, thank you for bringing this forward. You know, this, as you hear from the testifiers, it's a little bit like bringing broadband out to the rural areas where, for the company, it becomes cost prohibitive because you might have one connection per mile and so forth. This is kind of the same thing. So I see this primarily as an incentive to get into some of these areas, but also would help keep costs down, too, for folks. So thank you to the testifiers, and thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Any other members? I couldn't help but remember in the testimony from Mr. Thompson running the line down Parker Prairie, in Parker's Prairie, one of my tenant farmers there just got natural gas in the turkey operation. He said it was going to save about $2,000 a month. So that was pretty significant savings in terms of how agriculture is getting squeezed. Representative Nelson, you had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way, if I could understand this correctly, currently, because the lines aren't in the ground, we're not collecting the state tax on them now. And unless they build them, we're not going to collect any tax on them. So we're basically just obeying the tax or setting the tax off for 12 years and so they can get these built. And in the future, we're going to get more taxes being charged on these lines once they're put in and operational. That's, if I got that correct, that's what the
yeah, it's a 12-year moratorium on thank capital you, investment. Chair. Other questions, members? Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, just a minor clarification to that point, Representative Nelson, that the state general levy is set in law, and the amount that the state will take in is already determined. So if these pipelines go you know, under current law, if they go in, it doesn't really generate any more money for the state. It just lowers the rate and allows everybody else to pay a little less. But it doesn't result in added revenue to the state under current law.
And Mr. Hines, on that point, because the lines don't exist at this point, it doesn't really result in a shift of higher burden to anyone else. Kind of almost like the but-for test. All right. With that, Representative Barr renews her motion to lay over House File 4063 for possible inclusion. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next, we will move House File 4144. Representative Whalen moves House File 4144 for possible inclusion. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the time to talk about pipelines in the ground and the taxes that it creates. We've had bills in the past that we've heard from community leaders across the state about the concerns on the frequency and the scope of utility tax court appeals and the effects that tax refund orders can have on communities. I also know this issue firsthand as my district is home to several counties that are currently holding their breath, waiting for the news on what could be a multi-million dollar property tax refund order that they have no capabilities of paying back. To say the rules and the processes outlining the state assessment of utility companies is complicated is an understatement. It's also important to note that this issue affects all the counties in the corners of the state, from Clearwater to St. Louis County, Renville to Dakota. This bill would require the Department of Revenue to study the current system of utility assessments and prepare a report that will outline the frequency of appeals and settlements and the impact on local communities. This language would also ask the department to evaluate methodology used in other states and make recommendations that would provide more accurate assessment method that would hopefully provide for more stability and predictability in the future. In summary, this bill is an important start to reassuring communities across our state that we are not taking this issue lightly. As we continue to watch for decisions in the courts, we can be working ahead to try and start addressing this issue into the future to make sure that we aren't making a potential problem even larger. I thank you for your time, and hopefully it got passed out, House File 4144. My testifier from Clearwater County was not able to attend, and they are highly affected by the tax decision. I believe that their taxes, the return of taxes they would have to pay is over their own budget for the year. So unfortunately he couldn't come, but he did send a letter.
Thank you, Representative Keel. And I see you have a testifier.
Yes.
Would you like to state your name for the record, please? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Hilgart, and I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I want to thank Representative Keel and others, even on this committee, for their work over the course of 3 years for elevating this issue. And on behalf of AMC and the Minnesota Intercounty Association, I want to testify in support of this bill. I think Mr. Al Paulson's testimony, which everyone should have, is a good indicator of the sentiment of fear that a lot of these counties in this particular case, which is the Enbridge case, have in northern Minnesota. However, I think there's a greater concern about counties even outside this area, outside this case, of what the lack of certainty in these assessments means for budgeting and the ability to plan to keep levies low. I also think it's a good reminder, Representative Keel reminded us all, that this isn't just the Enbridge case, that Rule 8100, which is kind of the scope of this study, affects all state-assessed utility property. So it's outside of just these 13 counties. It's all over the state. So in closing, AMC and the Minnesota Intercounty Association, thanks Representative Keel and others for their work, and thinks that this is an important first step towards the greater goal of creating more stability and predictability in these assessments.
Thank you. Any other testifiers for House File 4144? I see Ms. Cadoon approaching the stand. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Cadoon, not Bath, which I believe is on your committee list, so I've not changed my name. Beth Cadoon with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for my ability to testify again. I want to thank Representative Keel for bringing forward this bill. We are here in support of the bill. We do think this is very important to study the valuation of these pipelines. I think it's clear that the current system is not working for ratepayers, for consumers, for the utilities, for the other taxpayers in the districts, and for the local governments. So we do believe it is time to see do the study, to look at these valuation methods. You always have, when you get your revenue estimate, there's always a summary of what are our principles we're supposed to be achieving in our property tax system. And so we do think it's important to look at our current valuation system to make sure it's transparent, it's understandable, it's efficient, it's competitive, and look at all those standards. And I think when you look at the current process, it just is not working. We would recommend and hope you can include this in your omnibus tax bill as it moves forward. We do think you might want to look at who you're going to have do the evaluation, though. We would suggest that maybe the Department of Revenue is not the right entity to be leading this. It might want to be a little more independent. As there is some ongoing disputes, it might be hard for them to have kind of an unbiased evaluation. So would ask that maybe look at who else might lead this effort. And then also we think there's actually other like investor-owned utilities that you must also include as part of looking at on how we're evaluating those properties as well. So with that, I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions for Ms. Cadoon or Mr. Hilgard for Representative Keel? Representative Markworth.
So, well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And going back to the letter from L. Paulson, the Clearwater Auditor, I don't know, Representative Keel, if your bill really addresses his concerns, because one of the things he's looking at is the state, the Department of Revenue, have set the valuation. And if it comes back, if the court case comes back in contrary, and they lose these revenues, what they're saying is they don't have in the budget to make up all of these revenues. And so he's basically asking, should the courts decide against the department, is the state of Minnesota willing to step in and help these entities that have had these over 50% of their tax base gone? So I'm just wondering, Representative Keel, if you have any thoughts on that. So if these cases come back and these counties lose this great amount of property tax base and hence property tax levy, do you think that's a state's obligation to provide funding to these counties or entities?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Markworth. In my past, I have carried some bills that require the department to work with the counties to help reduce the cost. We've had conversations about all kinds of ways to bring this down. There's been discussions about maybe interest-free. Some of these counties would still have trouble paying this back, and I think that's a conversation that needs to be had also. But this bill is intended to kind of review actually how it's even evaluated. And so I think a lot of our utilities are anxious to see if this is consistent, and especially with other states.
Representative Keel, thank you. Mr. Hilgard, you had a reply to Representative Markworth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Markworth, I think that's a very good question. It does not solve the underlying concern of if there is an order, let's say in the next even 2 months, saying that counties are required to pay back a significant amount of money. It does not solve that financial issue yet. And there has been a history of legislation dating as far back as the 2013 and 14 of us introducing items on this. I know Representative Lewick has carried a bill requiring the state to refund local governments in 2015. And then I believe Representative Sundin was in front of this committee just a month ago, also carrying that same language. So we are, AMC is interested in talking about that because we are concerned that it's a realistic possibility and scenario that the court will rule somewhere in between the two values of the state and what Enbridge is alleging their assessments to be. But this, we have heard concern from legislators about, well, even if the state provides some kind of aid, we want to make sure that going forward we have a more stable and predictable system. And I think that is completely fair. So after hearing those concerns the last couple of years, AMC as a delegation, as a membership, said it's in our due diligence as well to make sure that there's a consistent assessment going forth.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, no, I agree with this bill, and thank you for bringing it forward. I do think it's something, at least by next year, we may have to revisit as far as what is the state obligation. And I don't know how we would do that if it's an X percent over a county's tax base that they lose that we come in, or it's ratcheted in some shape or form. But I think we're going to end up revisiting this on the financial aspect maybe down the road. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anyone else? Ah, the tax man cometh. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cummins.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name
afternoon.
Is
afternoon.
Good afternoon. Oh, boy, this day is flying by. Must be the snow. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I wanted to thank Representative Keel for bringing the bill forward. I think that as the bill moves forward, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with Representative Keel and the committee to try and find the right criteria to ensure that we get responsive material in order to ensure that you can get what you're trying to do. I think you're looking for a solution, right, a way to move forward here. And I guess I just wanted to put on the record that the vast majority of the state assessed the assessments that go through our state assessed property system are not appealed, right? We have, I think we're talking about a couple cases here. We have and in this situation, we have a situation, and I think that it's certainly understandable when 50% of a county's budget is put towards one or two taxpayers, and then to have that taxpayer go to court and to claim, you know, that there's a change that they'd like to have in their valuation. In any company, that's sort of their ability to go and do. That's one way in which they try and maximize their bottom line, is to try and reduce their tax liability, and that's certainly understandable. Now, in jurisdictions all across the state, we have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of taxpayers. And each of those taxpayers could say, well, you know, that assessor put on, you know, two bathrooms on my house, or, you know, the remodeling that I did wasn't the type of remodeling, and my assessment shouldn't have gone up by that much, or there's an issue with this assessment or that assessment. And if we had, but households are, a very small portion, and there's many of them. And so there are times in which counties do hold aside a certain amount of money in case there's some volatility in terms of assessment. And so some of the things that we've talked about before have been, what are ways in which counties that may have one or two taxpayers that are very large, and in case there's volatility with that assessment like there would be in any other assessment, could there be a set-aside amount? In addition, we've also talked about an ability. Right now it's voluntary, but an ability under statute to allow a long-term ability for counties to enter into an agreement with pipelines, even if the pipelines said that they wouldn't do that. I think they're looking at a one-year payoff, and could it be long-term? I know that that was a solution, and it didn't seem to go anywhere. A couple other solutions. One was trying to work with the counties so that they could know more about the litigation as it's happening. One of the things that we heard was that counties wanted to know more. And there was general concern about the approach that we brought forward, but we have been trying to keep counties more engaged with sort of what is going on without talking about the litigation, although we would be open to talking more about the litigation if it's allowed under the law. And something that did pass was for some of our state-assessed properties that if they agree to, if they come to an agreement with the Department of Revenue on evaluation, then they could not appeal. And whereas before under statute that if they didn't, if they came to an agreement, they also could appeal. So that was just one way of trying to provide some certainty for local units of government. But with that said, you know, we are certainly committed to ensuring that we have a property tax system that works well for our taxpayers. There was a rule change in the late aughts that changed the way in which some of these properties are assessed. We're at a point now in which we see some companies that are trying to make some long-term investments or possibly make some long-term investments, and they're testing sort of the system of property taxes. So we want to ensure that we have a property tax system that works well for our taxpayers, other taxpayers in the jurisdiction, the taxpayers that obviously are being assessed, local units of government, state legislature, and anyone else. But with all that said, Mr. Chair, I think we, as this bill continues to move forward, we look forward to working with Representative Keel and the committee to try and find the right way to study this.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any questions from members for Mr. Cummings? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to testify? I see a gentleman. Please take a seat and identify yourself for the committee. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee, sir.
Hi, everybody on the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee.
Could you state your name?
My name is Rick Keller. I'm officially represent the twice exceptional Minnesota Statute 120B or House File 1072. And the
Mr. Heller, we're taking up House File 4144.
Okay, thank you. So, House File.
So, do you have anything to speak to House File 4144?
I do. House File 4144, just for the record, these documents are not posted online. They're created by Department of Revenue. The one dated August 1st, 2018, you have that in your possession, makes the legislature out of compliance with ADA of 2008. That's what I have to say. Thanks for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Anyone else? With that, concluding remarks, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would ask you to support this bill. I think we need to do the review and really assess why companies are looking at Minnesota saying that they're having challenges here in when they are in other states. So,
thank you. And with that, Representative Whalen renews her motion to move House File 4144 for possible inclusion. All those in favor, signify. It's time to. We don't have to vote. All right. Next on the agenda is House File 4268. I understand that Representative Erickson is going to present this bill for Representative Garofalo. The chair will move House File 4268 for possible inclusion. To the bill, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. House File 4268, Representative Garofalo's bill, modifies the definition of public facilities project. Currently in law, the definition is that any publicly owned facility or a facility owned by a nonprofit organization that is used for district heating or cooling is eligible to be financed with the proceeds of public facilities bonds as defined under Section 474A.02, Subdivision 23A. This proposal strikes the language owned by a nonprofit organization and adds language stating that if used for district heating or cooling, whether publicly or privately owned, it is eligible to be financed with proceeds of public facilities bonds. And, Mr. Chair, Andrew Chelseth is here from Stinson Leonard Street to speak to the bill.
All right. Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record, sir.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Okay. Chairman and members. Actually, I'm Mike Auger, and I'm general counsel.
Representative.
It's okay. I'm general counsel for Evergreen Energy. Evergreen Energy is based in St. Paul and designs, develops, operates, manages district energy systems in North America. District energy systems provide cost-efficient, reliable heating and cooling to commercial buildings, universities, government complexes, and other large public spaces. House File 4268 would remove the requirement that an entity be a 501c3 nonprofit to access public facility bonds to construct the distribution system for a district energy project. These bonds are backed by the project developer and private investors with no liability held by taxpayers. These projects would also need to demonstrate that they serve a public interest before moving forward. We see a number of opportunities for these projects in Minnesota in areas with aging central plant infrastructure. Removing the nonprofit requirement will expand the opportunity for valuable public-private partnerships to take place across the state. Finally, this change would also bring Minnesota into alignment with the current federal law in this area. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that. Questions from members? With that, concluding remarks, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing this proposal brought forth by Representative Garofalo. I ask for your support in laying it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. And with that, I will renew my motion to move House File 4268 for possible inclusion. Members, reminder, tomorrow we have another property tax meeting in this room at 3 p.m. And with that, members, our meeting is adjourned.